for advice on their own. So you have this direct access to the president based on ability to pay and prior relationships with him that is absolutely unprecedented. There is one example, though, that stands out above all the others, which is Carl Icahn, who's an old friend of the president's, who has been named his special regulatory advisor. He's not an actual government employee, but he has this special, at least according to the administration, he's got this special advisory role. And he's reportedly had a decisive impact over choosing who would lead the Environmental Protection Agency and the Securities and Exchange Commission, the two parts of the government that most directly relate to his business empire and his investment empire. And of course, we've got a guy running the EPA who is as hostile to the agency as is possible, who sued it 14 times and aims to destroy it. And we've got a guy nominated to run the Securities and Exchange Commission.
We've got about 10 seconds more. Go ahead.
Who is very likely to adopt rules that will benefit the giant investor, Carl Icahn himself.
Well, Robert Weissman, president of Public Citizen, thanks for joining us. That does it for today's show. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 27th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, taking place Thursdays through Sundays until March 4th at PCC Cascade in Portland. The Cascade Festival of African Films shows us Africa through the eyes of Africans, rather than a Vision of Africa package for Western viewers. The films celebrate Africa's achievements, expose its failures, and reveal possibilities for a hopeful future. The festival includes live music performances, plays and short films, documentary, and a Women's Filmmakers Week. Again, that's the 27th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, Thursday through Sundays until March 4th, at Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104 at Portland Community College, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. More information and specific times for the screenings can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Stand Together, a day of action workshop Saturday, February 25th, 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Stand Together is a day of workshops for people new to social and political action and for those upgrading their skills. Sessions include digital security, photography for action, strategic planning, nonviolent direct action, legal basics, know your rights, and more. Again, that's Stand Together, a day of action workshop, Saturday, February 25th, 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the First Unitary Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, Portland's neighborhood theater since 1924. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, and salads. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, laurelhursttheater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, not my President's Day rallies were held today in Portland and around the country.
New research finds that states that adopt same-sex marriage laws have seen reductions in teen suicide rates.
And Defense Secretary Jim Mattis visited Iraq today and denied reports that the U.S. intends to seize Iraqi oil resources.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 20th, 2017. I'm Zelle Marchant.
And I'm Ken Jones. Activists held Not My President Day rallies around the nation today to protest the current administration and its attacks on civil rights, justice, women, the environment, and more. One demonstration in downtown Portland, organized by Don't Shoot Portland and attended by at least a couple hundred people, began at 11 a.m. at the Federal Building. Protesters briefly blocked traffic at Southwest 3rd and Madison, and shortly before noon, police in full riot gear attacked the crowd, arresting about a dozen demonstrators. Several people were reportedly roughed up or assaulted by police, including some minors. The other rally, organized by the Oregon AFL-CIO, began at noon at Director's Park. Organizers of that rally, which had a couple thousand attendees, had secured a permit from the city. No arrests were made at that demonstration. This morning, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Teresa Rayford from Don't Shoot Portland to find out more about today's actions.
I'm Teresa Rayford with Don't Shoot Portland. Well, today is the President's Day national holiday, and here in Portland, a lot of people have been activated since the night of the election to basically protest the Trump administration and his agenda. And so with it being President's Day and also Black History Month, activists like myself that have been fighting against the oppression, doing the protests since Ferguson, fighting for our human rights and dignity, we feel like it's more than necessary for us to be out here to use those focuses and to make a statement directly to America that this person is not someone that we feel represents us. And what it is really a call to action to our local leaders to find out what do we need. What can they do? How can we work together with community to influence policy that will give us security?
For the benefit of listeners, how do they find out about future events moving forward? How do people get involved?
People can find us on Facebook. We have a website also called don'tshootportland.com, but on Facebook, we're Don't Shoot PDX. I also have a Twitter that's Teresa_Rayford, and I do a lot of the tweeting. Our Twitter page got kind of hijacked, so we don't have access to it. But yeah, you can find us on Tumblr, Facebook, and then the website. But Facebook is usually the most current.
What do you hope people will take away as far as messages today?
Well, today we have information from the ACLU about their legislative platform and some of the things that they're going to be pushing for. So we're here at the federal courthouse, the federal building, because we want people to think bigger. We don't want people to, beat down the mayor about what he can do. We want the people to use the time that they have with the legislator and talk to those people, bring it to the state so that they can bring it to the people that represent us in Congress and do what's necessary on a statewide level, because these issues aren't just happening in Portland. They're happening in every municipality throughout, but a lot of us don't have voices. We're trying to promote that the people and our voices are really the actual power source that we need, and we need to start using it.
Live in downtown Portland, and any closing thoughts, Teresa?
Just everybody stay calm and just stay engaged with politics. Don't worry about Trump. He's not that serious. The people and the power and the Constitution, we can get our liberties. We just have to recognize what those liberties are. Assert them. So today is not my President's Day. And as you can see on this sign right here at the federal building, it says Barack Obama, United States of America, General Services Administration, 2013. So if they never updated the building for Barack Obama when he won the presidency in 2014, that means that we probably have another 4 years of him before in Oregon they update their federal building. So yay for not having President Trump as a president, I guess, in Oregon. And we didn't even have to succeed, and we didn't have to petition for it to happen. We just are lazy, and we didn't update our buildings last time, so it won't get done. All right, I just wanted to do a disclaimer real quick. When you protest without a permit, it's called civil disobedience. Civil disobedience means that in protest against your government, that you will not pay taxes or fees or any permit costs for different things that are governed or our policies within your jurisdiction. And so we decided that we were not going to purchase a permit because we are in protest of our government, the federal government, our President Donald Trump. We didn't do it because we want to promote riots. We didn't do it because we just don't know the law. We know the law. You don't need a permit to protest. You have a constitutional right to do so. You also, like an editorial that was written in the Oregonian, that basically asked me to make sure that people don't wear masks, and that if I was a good, responsible organizer, that I would ask people to uncover their faces before they protest. Well, part of our Constitution allows for freedom of expression. And so when people come out and they're dressed in whatever gear that they're dressed in, however they're expressing themselves, whatever attire or accessories they have, that's part of their constitutional right. And so I never violate people's constitutional rights for freedom of expression. I would never ask anybody to take their mask down. If anything, I would ask you to put your hoodie up, block up. You know what I'm saying? Put your hoodie on and put your block up. You know? That's what I would ask for. So we're going to go ahead and protest. I want to make sure everybody has the Know Your Rights tags. I want to make sure everybody has information about the ACLU's legislative platform. The reason that we're here at the federal building is because right now in Oregon is the Oregon legislative session. And we have at least until June to talk to our state representatives, our senators, our congresspeople, and influence policy that's on the board right now. Now, in regards to the fight that we have in our community regarding marginalized communities, the platform is listed on this sheet right here that Red has, and she can pass some of that information out to you guys.
Say his name! What is he? Say his name! What is he? Say his name! What is he? Won't you say his name?
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
At approximately 9 a.m. on November 30th, 2016, Kristen Ramsey arrived at the Phillips 66 terminal to help protest the Philip Morris Company's involvement in the North Dakota Access Pipeline. Ramsey and another protester were pulled over by motorcycle officer Bill Balzan and cited for running two stop signs at the protest site. According to Ramsey, Officer Balzan stated before writing the tickets that he was, quote, he was writing them on behalf of another officer, end quote. According to court transcripts, that officer in question is Officer Steve Wilbon, who was off duty in police work that morning but was working as a contractor for Philip Morris at the 66 terminal where the protest took place, using an unmarked police vehicle and radio frequency. The citation lists Steve Wilbon as the officer conducting the traffic stop and Bill Balzan as a secondary officer. Oregon law requires officers to be on duty and present to write citations. After the February 14, 2017 hearing, Chris Ramsey versus Oregon State is set for appeals.
Portland Water Bureau officials have switched the city's water supply to emergency wells after the Bull Run water supply was found to be contaminated with cryptosporidium for the ninth time this year. Cryptosporidiosis, crypto for short, is a respiratory and gastrointestinal illness caused by a parasite commonly found in animal feces. Since no domesticated animals are allowed in the Bull Run watershed, it's assumed that the parasite is being transmitted by wild animals. Portland Water Bureau officials plan to continue to use the South Shore well fields for the immediate future to provide Portland's water supply. Those wells, which provide about half the capacity of the Bull Run water supply, are not a long-term solution. If testing continues to show evidence of the crypto parasite, the Portland Water Bureau may be forced to build an ultraviolet water treatment system. That treatment plan is expected to cost $100 million and would be funded by Portland Water Bureau customers.
Portland police are investigating a shooting this afternoon in southeast Portland. Officers responding to a 911 call around 2:30 p.m. found the wounded man at 82nd Avenue and Ramona Street. Police say the victim was seriously injured and was taken to a local hospital. The man who made the 911 call was involved in the shooting and is cooperating with the investigation. Police closed Southeast 82nd between Foster Road and Woodstock Boulevard and are advising drivers to take 72nd or 92nd Avenues.
The U.S. EPA has issued four exemptions to oil companies to dispose of fracking waste by reinjecting it back into California aquifers that are currently deemed to be potable and drinkable water sources. California is the third largest producer of oil and gas in the U.S., behind only Texas and North Dakota. In the last 6 years, oil and fracking companies have spent more than $120 million lobbying California politicians. During that same time, Governor Brown's administration has stopped a proposed statewide fracking ban, eased restrictions on oil drilling, and allowed fracking companies to illegally dispose of fracking waste into potable aquifers. In 2011, 2012, and 2014, the U.S. EPA found that the California State Agency tasked with implementing the Federal Clean Water Act had been negligent, with substantial implementation deficiencies in regards to regulating fracking waste. The agency was also found to have not been collecting the required fees from the oil companies. In response to the substantial deficiencies, California officials have asked the feds to issue exemptions to allow fracking waste to be pumped into clean water aquifers. EPA has already issued exemptions to allow the highly toxic fracking waste to be injected into four aquifers located in Kern County near Fruitvale. EPA is also looking at 40 more aquifers in California currently deemed potable for exemptions to dispose of fracking and oil drilling waste.
New research published today by the Journal of American Medical Association Pediatrics has found that states which have enacted laws allowing same-sex marriage have lower rates of teen suicide. This audio comes to us courtesy of JAMA Pediatrics.
This is Jim Michalski with JAMA Pediatrics. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among adolescents between the ages of 15 and 24 years. Adolescents who are sexual minorities are at increased risk of suicide attempts. We are joined by Julia Reifman of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore, co-author of a study which examined the association between state same-sex marriage policies and adolescent suicide attempts, and Mark Hatzenbühler of Columbia University in New York, who wrote an editorial on the study. First of all, Julia, could you tell us more about why you chose to examine this particular issue and how your study was conducted?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So the motivation for doing this study was evidence that gay, lesbian, and bisexual populations experience a range of health disparities, and that this is particularly true for adolescents. Lesbian, gay, and bisexual adolescents are nearly five times more likely to attempt suicide than their heterosexual peers. And in our study, we found that 6% of heterosexual adolescents reported attempting suicide in the past 12 months, compared to 29% of sexual minority adolescents. Sexual minority adolescents also experience disparities in depression, substance use, HIV, and in other sexually transmitted infections. And to me, these large disparities across domains of health suggested that structural stigma against sexual minorities may be playing a role in health disparities. State-by-state same-sex marriage decisions across regions of the United States and in different years provided a natural experiment for evaluating state-level structural stigma and how it affected health outcomes. We chose to focus on suicide because, as you mentioned, it's a major public health issue, the second leading cause of death among adolescents in the United States and an area in which sexual minorities experience health disparities.
And what were the main findings of your study?
So our primary objective was to evaluate the association between state same-sex marriage policies and adolescent suicide attempts among all adolescents. And our secondary objective was to evaluate this relationship among sexual minority adolescents. So what we found is that state same-sex marriage policies were associated with a 7% reduction in the proportion of all high school students reporting one or more suicide attempts in the past year. And among sexual minority adolescents, this was 14%.
Julie, what can you tell us about the methods used for the study?
So we used data from the Youth Risk Behavioral Surveillance System, which was collected between 1999 and 2015. And these data are representative of high school students in all 47 states that participated in the survey. It's a written survey that's supported by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and that takes place every other year in odd years. So one of the ways in which this study advanced upon prior studies is that it involved nearly all 50 states and that the data were representative of high school students in each state.
And Mark, could you touch on some of the points in your editorial?
Sure. So I tried to put this great study within a larger context of research on sexual orientation disparities in health and what we know about what might be contributing to them. So researchers have long hypothesized that stigma contributes to suicide outcomes among lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth. And most of that research has focused on stigma at the individual or interpersonal levels of analysis. So that is, studies have either examined how LGB individuals' responses to stigma, such as internalizing negative societal attitudes, or their interpersonal interactions, like rejection from family members, might influence their suicide risk. And that work has been really important because it's shown many of the ways in which stigma operates to harm the mental health of LGB adolescents. But that literature has tended to overlook what we call structural forms of stigma, which include, among other factors, laws and policies that either promulgate or institutionalize stigma against particular groups. And there's been some emerging evidence that state laws that limit rights and protections afforded to LGB populations are strongly associated with adverse outcomes among this group, but that work has really largely been conducted with LGB adults. And so this study by Dr. Raichman and her colleagues, I think, comes at a really important moment because it provides some new evidence of the role of state laws in shaping mental health outcomes among LGB youth.
Mark, what do you believe are the potential implications of the study findings?
Well, I think that the findings are important for two reasons. One is kind of methodological, and the other is substantive. I think with respect to methods, Dr. Raichman and her colleagues have really expanded the range and rigor of methods that have been used to study the impact of state laws on the mental health of LGB youth. And I think that's important because it's only by really triangulating evidence across multiple different types of methods that we can ultimately draw inferences about the relationship between structural forms of stigma and state laws and mental health of LGB populations. And then with respect to substance, I think the study provides some strong evidence that structural stigma in the form of state laws represents a potentially important, but I think largely thus far overlooked factor that might contribute to suicidality among LGB youth. So I think those results really highlight the fact that the legal climate surrounding LGB adolescents really deserves greater attention among medical professionals who are dedicated to reducing sexual orientation disparities and suicide outcomes among LGB youth.
Is there anything else either of you would like to add?
So in terms of things I would add, I would say that I think this study is interesting because we found that same-sex marriage policies affected high school students, and high school students are unlikely to marry in the immediate future. So that suggests that it's not a direct benefit from marriage that's driving this effect. It's likely that something about having equal rights or having more hope for the future, something else is driving the results that we see.
Thank you for talking to us about the topic of same-sex marriage policies and adolescent suicide attempts. This is Jim Schelsky with JAMA Pediatrics. For more author interviews, please visit us online at jamanetworkaudio.com or subscribe to these podcasts in iTunes or Stitcher.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special in-depth report from KBOO's Karen James about Critical Resistance Portland's new Mental Health Care Not Policing campaign. At 6, it's Labor Radio of the Working Class, by the Working Class, and for the Working Class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, dedicated to educating the public about the criminal justice system. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, showers likely before 10 p.m., then rain, likely after 10 p.m., mostly cloudy, with a low around 40. Chance of precipitation is 70%. Tomorrow, Tuesday, rain, high near 49, chance of precipitation is 100%. Today in history, in 1895, the social reformer, abolitionist, orator, and author Frederick Douglass died. And in 1962, NASA astronaut John Glenn became the first American to orbit the Earth in his Mercury capsule, Friendship 7. The quote for the day is from Frederick Douglass, who said, "Where justice is denied, where poverty is enforced, where ignorance prevails, and where any one class is made to feel that society is an organized conspiracy to oppress, rob, and degrade them, neither persons nor property will be safe."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. On Wednesday, the California Nurses Association, National Nurses United, and other supporters will join two state senators to celebrate introduction of a Medicare for All style bill for Californians. SB 562, the Healthy California Act, would create universal health care for California residents with effective cost controls. The Nurses Union, working with the Healthy California campaign, are the primary backers of the bill. They will will mark the introduction of the bill Wednesday with a rally supporting it in Sacramento. SB 562 says it is the intent of the legislature to enact legislation that would establish a comprehensive, universal, single-payer health coverage program and a health care cost control system for the benefit of all residents of the state. The American Federation of Teachers is joining Global Teachers Union Federation Education International in urging the UN to get involved in the 2014 case of 43 disappeared Mexican education students. Local police working for Mexican drug gangs kidnapped 43 students and all are believed dead. Texas AFT President Luis Malfaro tells Canada's Radio Labor,
"We've filed this with the UN Rights Council. And we're asking them to put pressure on Mexico to continue to investigate what happened there. Unions and civil society organizations represent an important front line in making sure we hold government accountable. This is something that our trade union movement has to speak out against."
United Teachers of Los Angeles has launched the second round of a We Are Public Schools ad campaign advocating for strong public schools. It includes more than 90 billboards and other advertising promoting public schools and highlighting the work of public educators. It's part of a larger struggle against the billionaire public education privatization agenda. UTLA says from Donald Trump and Betsy DeVos in Washington, D.C., to Eli Broad and Richard Reardon here in L.A., the campaign also exposes a handful of billionaires who are unfairly influencing local elections and education policy. In an interview with Quartz, Microsoft founder Bill Gates says if robots replace workers, they should be taxed like workers. Gates says that money could be used to transition human workers who lose jobs to robots into other jobs. Gates says the companies that replace human workers with robots should have to pay the equivalent of workers' income taxes on those robots.
Sponsored by Iron Workers Impact, now reserving spots for this year's groundbreaking conference, welcoming contractors to grow their business by networking and attending world-class breakouts. More on this event in San Diego, happening March 19th through the 22nd, is found online at impact-net.org under Events.
Brought to you by UnionJobs.com, posting jobs for unions, socially allied, and community organizations since 1997.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Simon & Schuster canceled publication today of the new book by controversial Breitbart News editor Milo Yiannopoulos. The cancellation follows yesterday's release of video clip showing Yiannopoulos condoning sex between men and young boys. In one of the clips, Yiannopoulos endorsed a, quote, coming-of-age relationship in which those older men help those young boys discover who they are and give them security and safety and provide them with love and a reliable sort of rock where they can't speak to their parents. The video clips were released by the Reagan Battalion, a blog that describes itself as news, information, and commentary from a conservative perspective. Simon & Schuster paid Yiannopoulos an advance of $250,000 for the book, titled Dangerous, which was due out in June. The book was controversial from the moment it was announced, generating anger and protest from readers and even a group of Simon & Schuster authors. While Yiannopoulos' racist, sexist, anti-Semitic, and transphobic rhetoric did not deter the publisher, apparently his endorsement of pedophilia was a step too far. As a result of the video clips, Yiannopoulos was also uninvited from speaking at the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, which starts this week.
Waterways threatened with nuclear waste. That and other stories on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water.
Waterways threatened with nuclear waste. That and other stories on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The nation's highways may become a bit more dangerous this spring.
On Tuesday, the Department of Energy announced that shipments of solid nuclear waste will soon start moving along our roads to an underground repository in southern New Mexico.
The shipments were halted 3 years ago after a radiation release contaminated the facility known as WIP, for Waste Isolation Pilot Plant.
Most of the waste will come from Idaho, 61 truckloads in all, but that's just a small fraction of the 900 shipments that are supposed to be made from that state by the end of next year.
All the nuclear waste going to New Mexico is solid.
But the Department of Energy also announced last week that it's planning to ship liquid nuclear waste along highways from Canada to the Savannah River site in South Carolina.
As Mother Jones reports, there will will be at least 100 to 150 separate truck shipments of liquid nuclear waste over a period of about 3 years.
Environmental groups, including the Sierra Club and Beyond Nuclear, recently sued to force the government to prepare a new environmental impact statement before starting the shipments.
But a federal judge in Washington, D.C. is allowing the shipments to go forward.
The liquid waste poses a bigger threat to the environment than solid waste if it spills into waterways or lakes.
Less than 2 ounces of the radioactive uranium could destroy a city's water supply, according to Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility.
If a spill contaminated the Great Lakes or any other waterway, it could be permanent. Officials will not disclose the routes of the shipments, which makes it impossible for people to take any action to prevent them.
It's been about 3 weeks since Iraqi forces took control of eastern Mosul from ISIS, and life is extremely difficult there. The water and sewer systems are not working.
Two reporters from the New York Times learned last week how residents in the liberated areas are getting water.
Using a sledgehammer to pound a steel pipe through concrete and shovels to dig, people have reached water sometimes after working for 3 days.
They said they don't drink the water, but only use it for washing clothes and cleaning dishes.
People can buy bottled water for drinking in some parts of liberated areas.
Iraqi forces are beginning an assault on the western part of Mosul. On Saturday, the United Nations warned that up to 800,000 people are at extreme risk due to lack of food, fuel supplies, and acute shortages of drinking water.
Last week, nearly 190,000 people were evacuated when officials worried that parts of the Oroville Dam in Northern California could fail.
Luckily, that didn't happen, but another storm is forecast to deliver heavy rain to the area, and it's possible another evacuation order could be issued.
The questionable safety of the Oroville Dam is nothing new.
The San Jose Mercury News reports that a little more than 10 years ago, three environmental groups told the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that the dam didn't meet safety standards.
They said fast-rising water would overwhelm the concrete spillway and then flow down the emergency spillway, possibly leading to flooding downstream.
But the state of California and various water supply agencies said the upgrades weren't necessary, and the feds agreed.
So the near disaster at Oroville has brought renewed attention to the problem of aging dams.
As detailed in Fortune magazine, 65% of dams in the U.S. will be past their 50-year designated lifespan in 3 years. And the American Society of Civil Engineers rates about 4,000 dams as being susceptible to failure.
The crisis with dams will be exacerbated by climate change, which is predicted to bring more extreme weather events and put stress on already weakened infrastructure.
A study published last week in the journal Nature concludes that the oxygen content in Earth's oceans declined by more than 2% between 1960 and 2010.
That's concerning because just a little loss of oxygen in coastal waters can lead to a complete change in ecosystems, according to David Baker at the University of Hong Kong.
He told CNN that the drop may have detrimental consequences for fisheries and coastal economies because fish can't survive in dead zones created by the lack of oxygen.
The dead zones also pump out nitrous oxide, another harmful greenhouse gas.
The cause of the decline is partly a result of climate change. Warmer water holds less oxygen, but as the surface waters get warmer, the oxygen is less likely to sink to layers below.
Baker said that the oceans are really a mirror of human health. If they're sick and dying, then that's the future of mankind as well.
And finally, when you gotta go, you gotta go. And that can be challenging if you're an astronaut. It's not like you can just pull into a gas station.
NASA has been working on this problem and has made advances since the days of plastic bags. The fancy International Space Station toilets suction human waste and then jettison it from the ship, where it catches fire in the atmosphere, looking like shooting stars.
But what they haven't quite got down is what to do on spacewalks. Right now, astronauts wear diapers, but they're limited. They're only good for about 10 hours.
What the space agency wants is something that will allow the astronauts to be out and about for longer days, not hours. If we're going to explore places like Mars, we're going to need to keep astronauts safe from their feces and urine.
So they announced the Space Poop Challenge to crowdsource a solution. About 5,000 people from more than 150 teams submitted some pretty badass ideas.
The winner was Thatcher Carden, a family physician and Air Force flight surgeon. Inspired by operating techniques like catheters, he came up with a concept to locate a tiny valve in the suit's crotch through which astronauts can insert and remove expandable diapers and underwear.
Wondering about the toilet paper? Carden's plan includes something called a hygiene wand, a tip covered with bunched fabric that's pulled in a motion similar to a sock being turned inside out.
NASA engineers are going to take the top three winning ideas and test them for their next generation spacesuit. Their lab notes for the poop in a suit? We'd call that a captain's log.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Build a better world through better water at AWWA's ACE 17 in Philadelphia, June 11th through 14th. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE17.
The plight of what the United Nations says is now more than 20 million refugees worldwide is still in the spotlight. Uncertainty prevails after a federal court refused to reinstate President Trump's travel ban on people from seven Muslim-majority nations. The U.S. has also suspended the country's refugee program for 4 months and indefinitely barred Syrian refugees. What comes next is unclear, but reports indicate that a new executive order is in the works that would scale back the original travel ban enough to pass constitutional muster. President Trump has also cast doubt about the future of an Obama administration resettlement deal with Australia, under which refugees currently languishing at the Manus Island and Nauru detention centers would be relocated to the U.S. Tensions are high and court actions ongoing as promises of resettlement get caught up in politics and trigger false hopes. For almost 14,000 refugees in Indonesia, this plight's a daily reality. Indonesia has a long history of welcoming refugees for temporary settlement, but with just 610 refugees permanently resettled in 2015, the majority are left facing an uncertain future. And this month, tensions came to a head as dozens of refugees attended the UNHCR in Jakarta for the third day in a row, holding signs reading, "Save Us," and begging staff to decide their fate. Unable to work or access education means much of their life is spent in limbo. But as Georgia Clark with Free Speech Radio News reports, one learning center outside of Jakarta is on a mission to change that.
A little more than 50 miles outside of the bustling streets of Jakarta, where skyscrapers loom above impoverished local shops or warung, more than 100 refugee children are 1,000 miles from home. Unable to work or easily access public education, even the necessities of daily life are hard to come by. But here at the refugee-established Cisarua Learning Centre, almost 100 of these children have the chance to go to school, perhaps when they need it the most. One student, 12-year-old Matin Kazimi, came to Indonesia to escape war-torn Afghanistan.
Before we came to school, I was depressed at home. I was really sad at home because I had no friends, I had nothing to do. But when the day which I heard that there is a school opened by the refugees, a gleam of hope was seen in my heart. I came to school, I found friends, I studied, and I really enjoyed new school. We're refugee in here, so we don't have the permission to travel in another city or something. But at least this school gave us something to do, to study. This school gave us football, this school gave us studying, this school gave us hope.
For the 14,000 refugees in Indonesia, including 6% who are unaccompanied minors, access to education is extremely limited. In 2015, only 51 school-age refugee children were enrolled in public schools. The waiting list here is inundated, and according to one teacher, Sadiq, its funding from the Australian non-profit Cisarua Learning Inc. could be pulled at any time.
We have more than 10,000 refugees in here. We are just a small place. We may support the students, we may teach the students, we may get involved some of the students, few of the refugees, but again, how about those who are still in waiting list. We're still waiting outside to get in this school. I think we may need much support from people. Refugees are good people, human beings. They're just like other people.
Situated in an area populated by 3,000 refugees in the valleys of Bogor, the Chisarawa Learning Centre is no ordinary school. It's run by refugees for refugees. The students and teachers alike have fled their homes, escaping war and rampant poverty. Matin's teacher, Farinaz, is one of five women in her family. She's an ethnic Hazara and in Afghanistan was not allowed to leave her house at night or to continue her education.
Afghanistan is not safe. There is always bomb blows. People are dying there. And especially Hazara people. Their target is Hazara people. Because I'm a Hazara, so I have to leave my homeland.
Like Farinaz, the majority of refugees here are from Afghanistan. Because Indonesia is not a signatory to the 1951 UN Convention relating to the status of refugees, until last month, the country had no protocols for how to handle refugees. But in recent weeks, the nation's president, Joko Widodo, announced regulations providing a legal framework for refugees. 18-year-old Farinaz volunteers at Chisarawa, teaching art.
My habit is to do art, and I'm teaching art here in each and every classes.
Matin Kazimi's brother, 16-year-old Amir, is a student leader at the school. While he is proud of the centre, he says it's important to remember that it is not a permanent solution.
Learning centre is just an education. I know that it is a hope for all of us, but still there are thousands of others who do not have education, who are really far from their families, and thousands of others waiting in limbo.
The new regulations do provide legal status for refugees, but access to education remains problematic, and the waiting list at Chisarawa is growing. According to Farinaz, there is much untapped potential among the refugee population.
There are many skills here. There are many great people there, but they can't show it to the world. They can't help, actually. They can't help the world through that because we are unknown people now. Refugees are, people have no idea about it, but we are human actually. We have the same quality that everyone have. We can bring huge change to the world if the world let us, if the people let us.
After 3.5 years in Indonesia, this week Matin and Amir received good news. Despite a clampdown on refugee resettlement in the US, its neighbour to the north remains welcoming. The two boys found out that they'll be resettled in Canada, and their dreams of finishing high school and going to university are within reach. Farinaz, meanwhile, will continue volunteering at Chisarawa and dreams of finding a home in a third country. Georgia Clark, FSRN, Jakarta.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis paid a surprise visit to Iraq today to meet with military commanders and political leaders. According to Mattis, U.S. troops will remain in Iraq for the foreseeable future. Mattis said that he was open to the use of more U.S. troops in the campaign to capture Mosul. He also indicated a willingness to use U.S. troops in Syria in the fight against the so-called Islamic State. Secretary Mattis denied reports that the U.S. plans to seize Iraq oil, an idea put forward by the current president.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ken Jones and Don Zur. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News, Workers Independent Network News, and HTO Radio. Our engineer is Danielle Parks, the KBOO Evening News Director is Zell Marchant, and the Evening Public Affairs Director is Kanan Schlesinger. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Zell Marchant. Promos for February 21st. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show takes your calls. At 9, on Alternative Radio, Georgetown sociology professor Michael Eric Dyson unpacks white privilege. At 10, Chris Andrea hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, DeMay Roberts welcomes Bag and Baggage Productions and the Northwest premiere of Bronte. And at 11:30, Art Focus speaks to Beresford Booth from the Portland Art Museum about the current exhibition, Constructing Identity. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Zell.
Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Critical Resistance Portland is a group of dedicated prison industrial complex abolitionists. KBOO's Karen James spoke with Critical Resistance Portland about mental health care, not policing, their campaign to shift away from the use of Portland police as first responders when people are suffering a mental health crisis. Critical Resistance Portland will hold a meeting on February 25th to share ideas and build a coalition to work toward decreasing Portland's reliance on police.
I'm here with Maria Boyer and Corey Lira from Critical Resistance Portland. Corey, who is Critical Resistance Portland, and why are you interested in a campaign to stop Portland police as first responders in a mental health crisis?
Well, Critical Resistance Portland is a chapter of a national movement to abolish the prison industrial complex. And often the narrative is that the system is broken and we need to fix it. And for us, it's really about saying the system is designed to work exactly the way it is right now, which is to control, harm, cage our communities, and to be part of the system of violence that's really about state control of those most vulnerable communities. And so for us, this is about really addressing that long